Hello, and welcome to Strategies for Post-COVID Commercial Payer Reimbursement Planning webinar, presented by Polsinelli. Today's webinar is being recorded and will be available for replay within 24 hours on our website, as well as our COVID-19 blog. If you have questions regarding today's content, please reach out to our COVID-19 task force. This contact information can be found on our COVID-19 blog. To access the COVID-19 blog, please reference the resources tab located next to the speaker bios. If you experience any technical difficulties, please type your question in the Q&A box and our engineer will assist you. To access the materials from today's webinar, please reference the resources tab. I would now like to turn the webinar over to Polsinelli shareholder, David King.
Thank you, Ashley. I'm David King. I'm a shareholder in the Nashville office of Polsinelli. I'm joined today by Jonathan Buck, a shareholder in our Los Angeles office. Jonathan and I focus our practices on managed care strategy, contracting and disputes. Jonathan approaches this practice with a strong background as a former in-house counsel with a large hospital system for several years, and I've come into this practice as a longtime healthcare litigator. As you will quickly find out if you don't already know, we represent hospitals and health systems and other providers. We do not represent payers, and so our perspective is that from the provider side. For this presentation, we have our contact information is on the first slide here, and so feel free to reach out to us if you have any questions that come up after our presentation, and we'll be happy to answer as best we can. And as Ashley pointed out, we also have a firm email address that you can write to with general questions that relate to COVID-19. Our firm covers all of these issues all across the board from several different disciplines, so we're happy to help any way we can. And so today's presentation is the second in a two-part presentation that Jonathan and I have done. We did one on May 27th about current issues with COVID-19 commercial reimbursement. And today we want to follow up on that presentation. Our title is Strategies for Post-COVID Commercial Payer Reimbursement Planning. But in fact, at the beginning, what we want to do is follow up on some additional questions that we've heard related to COVID reimbursement as we evolve beyond the reimbursement for testing and we get into treatment issues, eventually, hopefully, vaccine issues and other things. And so we have a little laundry list of items that we've heard in the healthcare community that we want to start putting on everybody's radar. And so that's where we start. And then again, to remind everybody, we all know from the hospital and other provider side that, you know, everyone is hurting. We've had lots of challenges with payer mix problems, with service mix problems, with volume problems. And so from the provider perspective, you know, we have significant financial strains. I read an article recently where hospitals are losing about $1.4 billion in revenue per day. On the other hand, because of the lack of elective care and decreased volume, the payers are actually saving a lot of money. I've heard one estimate a month or so ago where the payers actually have saved about $20 billion, are expected to save $20 billion over the next several months because of not having to pay for claims. We also know that they were successful in the U.S. Supreme Court recently in their litigation related to the risk corridor payments for 2014 and 2015. And that resulted in an estimated $12 billion gain for the health insurance companies. And so we have kind of an uneven scale right here between the payers and the providers. And so for today's discussion, we want to first focus on planning for COVID-related payer policy changes and audits. We've seen lots of payer policy changes regarding testing. There may be additional changes that come up. And we can certainly expect to see some audits on the back end. So we want to talk about that. And then next, we want to talk just about the idea of tackling past claims backlogs that you have, where you have longstanding issues with these payers that haven't been resolved. And our suggestion is, to the extent you have the capacity to deal with these issues, it's a good time to try to clean up some of these past claims. Then we're going to talk about anticipating changing healthcare delivery models. I mean, we all know what's happening now with telehealth and other things. And so we want to talk about that a little bit. And then finally, we want to talk about navigating increased regulatory involvement in arrangements. And by the way, if you have any questions along the way today, we have a Q&A box that you can ask the question and we'll do our best to answer. So now I'm going to turn it over to Jonathan Buck to talk about planning for COVID-related payer policy changes and audits. Jonathan?
Thank you, David, and good morning or good afternoon to you all, depending on where you might be. Thanks for joining us today, and we know time is at a premium for all of you, so we appreciate your willingness to spend an hour with us and talk about these issues that we're seeing and anticipating. As we look at some of the issues surrounding payer policy changes and audits that we anticipate to occur, we're looking at a couple of different areas. Number one, we're going to have some specific payer policies that still deal with COVID-related testing and treatment. And then you're also going to be encountering payer policies that may have been slated for implementation but were suspended due to the pandemic, and payers now re-engaging their efforts to implement those policies going forward. And so some of those might relate to site of care limitations or authorization restrictions for where certain services can be provided on a medically necessary basis. The hot one is always things such as CTs and MRIs and whether they can be referred to an outpatient hospital department as opposed to a freestanding center. Those policies are going to continue to evolve and be implemented. So as we look at our preparation on these evolving payer policies, you can see that we've listed some things that we're anticipating where you're going to have some pushback or lack of clarity and lack of consistency across payers. So some of these are going to relate to continued pushback on reimbursement for antibody testing, issues with non-waiver of patient cost sharing for treatment. You have some plans that voluntarily have chosen not to impose cost sharing for such treatment, but the waiver of cost sharing for testing should be fairly uniform, but the treatment is still an issue where it's not necessarily required. We're also seeing questions of when cost sharing should or should not be waived if COVID-19 is not coded as the primary diagnosis. You know, this can occur in a variety of settings, both the coding of it as well as the associated visit here in the next bullet, because what is happening is, you know, certain things are keyed and reimbursement is triggered based on a primary diagnosis, but what happens when COVID may be suspected and driving some of the testing and treatment done, but the patient's negative? And so we're seeing issues with that and anticipating that's going to continue to come up. You know, and then we're still expecting issues with cost sharing and even reimbursement for COVID testing that was done early on. So be mindful and wary of your earliest claims related to COVID testing and treatment, and making sure that you're looking at those with a fine eye to make sure that the payer is adjudicating it correctly and that certainly you're not imposing cost sharing where none should be imposed. Finally, we continue to see policies where it's almost done as a catch-all by the commercial payers for government reimbursement rates on commercial products for COVID testing and treatment. And then finally, every payer has kind of done something a little bit different in terms of whether they're voluntarily taking on waivers that may have been done elsewhere or with states that have not extended waivers. So it's a somewhat of a hodgepodge of regulatory confusion, if you will, when you are transcending states. So certainly be mindful of what is existing in your primary state, but if you're organizations transcend markets, transcend states, you're going to be facing some inconsistencies with how things are occurring from state to state.
And Jonathan, one thing that I'll also add to is as you think about all of these evolving questions, it's important to think about what's your process for how you're going to evaluate these changes. And so I just jotted down a few ideas. The first thing that you're going to want to look at is what does the federal law say about this particular issue? And so look at the CARES Act, look at the Families First Act, and does the law itself, I mean, for example, in our last webinar, we talked about plans trying to apply government rates for commercial claims, and we found in the CARES Act where they can't actually do that. So the first place to look is at the CARES Act itself. The second place to look is at the guidance, the regulatory guidance, and you know, for the CARES Act, we look at the Department of Labor and the Department of Treasury. And as we talked about last time, for example, where we have plans saying, well, this is what we're going to do for our insured business, but for our self-funded plans, you know, if they don't decide to opt in, we're not going to deem that they are subject to these requirements. Well, we've seen very good guidance from the Department of Labor and Department of Treasury that says, no, all of these requirements apply to self-funded plans as well. So that's the second thing to look at. Then third, you know, consider state statutory guidance or regulatory guidance to see what they say about various things. You know, you're not going to have the same argument as to self-funded plans because you may have a risk of preemption there, but you still may have it apply to your other plans that you have, including the commercially insured plans. And then lastly, just for my little list here, look at what the payers are saying. And so just for example, as I was preparing for this webinar today, I was Googling around and I came upon the AHIP website, you know, America's Healthcare Plans, the lobbying group for the health insurance side. Well, they have a 77-page blog that has an alphabetical list of all of the health plans around the country, the national plans and the various state plans, and they describe in there what they do. And so, for example, you can see what Cigna does, what United says that they do. And I kind of scrolled through that a little bit, and I saw some common themes. One, there were several references to covering associated treatment as well as the testing. But the problem that I saw on several of those indications was that extended rule cut off on May the 31st. So that's already expired. So it's important to look to see if they're going to extend those deadlines. And then they also go ahead and try to have the disclaimer that it may or may not apply to self-funded plans. So for your given state or if you're on a national basis, you might take a look at the AHIP website to see what they say about the plans, and obviously looking at the plans websites themselves. All right. Jonathan, you want to talk about audits for a little bit?
Yeah, thanks, David. The other thing we're anticipating beyond the policy changes either being newly implemented or new policies being driven is the impact from activities that were suspended during this emergency time and payers coming back on the back end to audit various claims or services that were provided during the pandemic, which were not subject to or followed a rigorous authorization process or review process. This is going to impact our providers in several fashions, but number one, you're going to have some issues with resources. And so anticipate that you are going to need some clinical staff to be providing some presentation of medical and clinical documentation on claims after the fact and supporting the services that were provided. We also anticipate you're going to be needing to explain your volume of service changes. Obviously, elective services have gone way down due to the orders. But related to this would be explaining the modification of service changes too. So if your organization has had to implement different flows of patients, different care necessary in order to treat patients, you know, the one thing I think of is certain processes where COVID testing has to be administered before the patient is admitted for a surgery or something like that, where extra services were necessitated. Be prepared to explain those and show them in the documentation. With the payer policy changes, it's certainly good practice to be mindful of what the plans are issuing on their websites, but make sure that if you're required to be given notice of these payer policy changes, that formal notice has actually been provided. Finally, the emergency services documentation and billing changes, these are probably going to be some of the more rigorous audited aspects. Obviously, with emergency services, mostly there is a prudent layperson standard attached to it. And so we anticipate there's going to be some discussions about whether a patient was actually a prudent layperson seeking treatment at the emergency room during the COVID-19 pandemic, if their belief in having an emergency condition was reasonable. This is something that comes up in normal claims and retrospective reviews of emergency services. But with a flurry of ER visits as the primary gateway into a hospital, I think you're going to see this aspect audited even more rigorously on the back end by the payers. Same with various coding and modifiers, making sure that the bills and the records are consistent and supporting what was actually done with the patient and accurately billed. You know, I think payers are going to be auditing and finding some discrepancies and variances related to services that might have been provided on a telehealth basis, but expect to be reimbursed as if it was provided in the institution. So with those are certain keys that we expect are going to be audited by the plans on the back end, and that these will likely start occurring this coming fall, if not before. Various states are implementing different end times for their, you know, directions for payers to suspend certain activities or whatnot. So be mindful of what your specific state is doing, as well as announcements by the plans, like through the AHIP website that David referenced. You know, have they put in an end date of when they're going to waive cost sharing or when they're going to, you know, reinstitute prior authorization requirements?
And two other things that I worry about on this, in this category of audits. You know, we all know about the plans, you know, waiving pre-authorization, and that might tend to give us a false sense of security to the extent we've had an inpatient admission or surgery for obviously non-COVID related items. And what's going to happen on the back end? Are we going to be faced with a lot of medical necessity reviews that even though you didn't get pre-authorization, the plan is still going to apply all of its traditional rules and standards that you thought was not going to be an issue and you didn't really have a chance to deal with it as part of a pre-authorization process? So I think it's really important to be prepared for these medical necessity challenges and also to be prepared to articulate why the circumstances during that time frame should lead to a relaxation of the standard. And we know from our last presentation, we talked about the supplement to the New York Insurance Circular number 8, where the court actually, not the court, but the regulator actually talked about relaxing those standards during the pandemic period of time. The next thing that I worry about is a plan having more contract rights, trying to declare more rights for a retrospective review than the contract might otherwise allow. So it's important to look at your contract. What are the retrospective review rights? What do they extend to? And what's the timeline that is applicable? And then also look at your state law to see if it has a shorter timeline than what the plan is trying to do.
And as we talk about the contract pieces, just a couple quick follow-ups here on slide 8, David. Certainly there are often limitations or restrictions on time frames for retrospective audits in your agreements. Make sure you're understanding what your rights are, both with respect to policy changes and with respect to these audits. I get concerned when you see blanket language in agreement that says simply the payer has the right to deny if the claim was not prior authorized. And so with these audits, you're going to be navigating, you know, interim patchwork workarounds that such services could be provided and approved without authorization, you know, but also facing arguments from the plan that they do have the right to deny. So to the extent that your contracts are in place and you have strong language, be prepared to rely on those language terms in working through audits and hopefully not having any clawbacks or offsets. You know, that's the further angle in your agreement that you're going to want to be aware of, is what right does the plan have to simply do its own audit without the provider's participation and then issue a report and start implementing clawbacks and recoupments. Certainly be prepared to object and substantiate your services. All right. As we look at where, go ahead. I was just going to say, in addition to the large amounts of funds that health plans are holding on to or have received at this point, You know, we do see this as an opportunity for providers to try and rectify past claims backlogs, both to try and achieve a clean slate coming out of this, because the delivery of healthcare, as we'll talk about later, will change in some ways. And also because payers, in addition to those funds, they also have their own obligations with their medical loss ratios. And with the significant decrease in services through at least the first quarter and probably transcending through the final, you know, second quarter of this year, you're looking at plans probably being significantly below their medical loss ratios for amounts spent on claims. So we find this to be a very good opportunity for past claims to be cleaned up and worked through with payers. And, you know, this allows the plans to also expend funds, you know, for medical claims that affect the ratio. David?
Yes, and so when you think about your past claims, based on our experience, and this may not be new to any of you, but just as a refresher, it's really important to categorize where you have your problems with past claims. And the way we like to do it, as I'm sure many of you do, is number one, what are your trended issues? What are the issues that are out there that you can apply to many claims, that you can then put those claims into that category and challenge that trended issue on an aggregated basis? So you may have an issue where a plan says, okay, this item is no longer separately reimbursable, or some other trended issue where you can escalate that issue, not just with your administrative appeal process, but with another escalation process that can involve a letter writing campaign to the plan where you try to escalate it to the right people and deal with it on a macro basis, where once you solve the problem, hopefully successfully, it will impact you in a lot of claims. So there's a good bang for the buck in terms of what you do there. And then number two, obviously you're always looking for your high dollar claims, no matter what the issue is. You know, what is happening here, even if it's an isolated issue, have an escalation process so you just don't let that go. And then three, the payer policy changes, as we've talked about throughout. You can have COVID-19 related payer policy changes. You can have any other sort of payer policy change. It can come out in an announcement that you're required to get as notice under your contract. Sometimes plans try to do it just by a website announcement or an amendment to their payer provider manual that they have incorporated by reference into your contract. It's really, really important to track those payer policy changes, figure out what your rights are to get notice and make sure they gave you the right notice, and figure out what your rights are to challenge. Hopefully, you've got language in your contract that gives you some leverage there. For example, if you have language that says any payer policy changes have to be revenue neutral, well, then you've got a leg to stand on there. But what you don't want to have happen is, number one, you never heard about or saw about the payer policy change, and it gets implemented, and you don't even figure it out until you get to the end of the year and you see that your expected payments are way down. Or two, you know about it, but it didn't escalate to the right person within your organization or group, and you didn't do anything about it. And so you can run into a problem with course of dealings where you have a series of payer policy changes that are detrimental to the provider, and you haven't done anything about it. So really important to have a process for identifying and tracking and challenging those payer policy changes. And they're happening more and more frequently, as we all know, but really hard to kind of figure those out. And then lastly, we have the category, kind of the miscellaneous category of general denials. And unfortunately, for many of the big hospital systems, you can have a whole lot of money in your AR that are in the general denials category. And so you've got to figure out, how can I sort out these general denial claims to see if there's any good money there that's worth pursuing? So we'll talk about that in a minute. So after you have some sense of how you categorize your claims, you've got to think within each category, how do you prioritize what you're looking at? And so I think the very first thing is, what are the applicable deadlines? And so if we have a payer policy challenge, and the policy says you've got 30 days, or the contract says you've got 30 days to respond, or it's deemed accepted, well, that's obviously, you know, a really urgent matter to take up. Obviously, dollars at issue are important. If you see big dollars out there, even for a single claim, really important to jump on that claim and figure out what's happening. And then, obviously, especially as you get down to the bottom of the list for general denials, what are the resources needed to gather and organize the claim information? And is it going to be worth my while? And that's why it's really important to do the first step of the trended issues and the payer policy changes, so you can use limited resources to try to get the best bang for the buck. And obviously then, as you further evaluate, what are my chances of success? And then lastly, what's going on with the payer? And so, for example, am I right on the verge of a contract renewal? Okay, well, that doesn't necessarily say don't fight with them about these issues. It might mean that you need to fight with them about these issues, and you need to say, hey, you know what? You only want to give me a 2% increase next year. Well, we figured out with your payer policy changes, you actually have taken back 6% by not paying us on our claims. And so being armed with that information can really help you in your negotiation, and you figure out, you know, what's my effective rate increase that's going on there. And I think the plans honestly do that as well. You know, I've gathered information where they say, hey, you know what, just go ahead and give them that 5% because we're going to take it back with all the other things we're going to do to them, because they agreed to allow us to change all of these things in the middle of the contract. So really important to understand the status. And I'll give two other practice pointers just based on my experience. If providers, sometimes payers put out these new policy changes, and they just wait to see if anybody's going to push back. And if nobody pushes back, then they think that they have clear sailing, and then they push it through on a broader basis. That's on a macro level. On a micro level, I think plans really pay attention to who they see as kind of a stooge, who's just going to take whatever we do to them and not say anything about it. And I think that is just going to empower them to abuse the situation even more. So I think all of those things need to be taken into account as you think about your relationship with the payers. Now getting into kind of data analytics, this is a really, really important aspect. And especially as your managed care departments are resource constrained, it's still really important to have really good data analytics that help you support all of this analysis. You know, when you're looking at your buckets of claims, how can you determine what am I dealing with in denials? What am I dealing with in clinical denials, technical denials? So as you drill down, for example, you could find out, well, you know what, for this given hospital, I've got a whole bunch of claims that are denied. Well, they're all technical denials because I didn't get pre-authorization. Well, what's happening there? And so you can really do kind of a root cause analysis to figure out, do I have an issue here with a given physician, for example, who isn't getting pre-authorization, or do I have some other process problem that I can solve? And then suddenly my denial rate, you know, goes way down. Next thing to think about, and this is especially important for if you're out of network, are misclassified claims, where you have, you know, where emergent versus non-emergent is really important in terms of how your reimbursement is. What is your methodology to figure out if you're paid on an emergent basis or a non-emergent basis? And then, of course, underpayments. And this can come, you know, not only in the out-of-network situation, but also in-network. And I've just heard about a situation where a hospital dealt with a payer, and they, you know, they finally got a rate increase, and then come to find out, well, the payer never actually loaded the new rates. And so really important to model your expected payments. And if you have significant discrepancies or any discrepancies, challenge the payer about what's happening there. And then, of course, we, you know, we've talked about the payer policy changes.
And one thing I would add, David.
Yeah, go ahead, Jonathan.
While we're talking a lot about your past claims and backlogs, and that's indicative of things that existed prior to the pandemic. We think it's also important that you're bucketing the issues of the COVID-19 claims as we go through, so that you're ready to present them maybe at the end of the pandemic period to say, here's all our diagnostic testing claims, here's all our antibody testing claims, here's all our COVID-19 reimbursement claims and the issues that were caused and what the expectation was or claims for the telehealth, if you will. So just having those ready during this time period for and identifying those issues so that you can tell the story to the payer when ready, we think is also important.
Yes, great. And then as you further drill down on your data, and you start thinking about escalation strategies, perhaps you get to the point where you're ready to bring in outside counsel, then it becomes important to think about, okay, how am I going to assemble these claims so that I can get the most claims together for a given dispute? And obviously that's going to depend upon your contract. Do you have consolidation rights under your contract? Do you have more than one hospital governed by a certain contract? And obviously then you look at other parameters. You look at, okay, maybe I have several hospitals in one state. Okay, how many claims do I have in that state? And what does that look like? What do the claims look like by hospital? What about the different payer classes that I'm dealing with? And then by payer themselves, you know, how many claims do I have against Blue Cross Tennessee? How many do I have against Cigna? And you can slice and dice this data, if you're not doing it already, to really help figure out an escalation strategy that can be as efficient as possible and give you the best chance of recovery. And then next, a payer engagement audit is really important. And so now, aside from just dealing with the claims themselves, we think it's really important to take an opportunity when you have any sort of time and resources to take a refreshed look at what you're doing with your administrative processes. You know, for example, something as simple as your conditions of admission form or your assignment of benefits. Am I using the latest, greatest language in my assignment of benefit language? Something that makes sure that as I'm standing in the shoes of the patient, do I have all of the same rights that the patients have? And that can be really important. So if you have to get to where you file an ERISA lawsuit on behalf of a patient, you want to make sure, and this can get into the technical weeds, that you have not only the rights to pursue a claim, but potentially the right to seek equitable relief, to allege that the plan violated its fiduciary duty. Well, you have to have certain language in your assignment of benefit form to not get thrown out of court for lack of standing. If you're in a state or dealing with a plan that has anti-assignment language and you run into that frequently, you need to think about, okay, how can I deal with a plan that has anti-assignment language? How can I deal with the plan that says, even though I have a solid assignment of benefits, they just tell me, hey, you know what? We don't accept provider appeals. We're only going to talk to the member. Well, what are you going to do about that? What does the law say about that? What type of claim do you have? And what you don't want to do is just accept the answer. And I can't tell you how many times I've had a situation representing a hospital or a hospital system, and they said, well, XYZ insurance company said I couldn't file a provider appeal. And so we didn't. Well, guess what happens when you end up in arbitration or in court? Their lawyer gets involved, and the first thing they say is failure to exhaust administrative remedies. And we say, oh, well, your person told us we didn't need to exhaust. Okay, well, that person either didn't say it or wasn't authorized to say it, and then you're stuck. So really important to not only have a strong assignment of benefits, but then follow the administrative processes. And typically that means you're going to file a first-level appeal, sometimes called a reconsideration. Sometimes that's done orally. Sometimes it's in paper. And as part of that first level administrative appeal, it's really important to, if you have an ERISA claim involving an employer-sponsored health plan, to ask the plan to provide certain information that's required by law. For example, citing the specific reason for the adverse benefit determination, referencing the plan provision that relates to that adverse benefit determination. You want to, even though the plan has a legal obligation to provide that information, even without you asking for it, you want to be on record of asking for that information. If the plan doesn't provide it, that's going to give you leverage down the road in dealing with that claim in a legal forum. And when I say two levels of appeal, it's really important. I mean, some providers might say, well, we did one level of appeal and they denied it, and we thought it would just be a waste of time to do a second level of appeal. Well, that would be a futility argument. The problem with that is, many courts say a futility argument means it's impossible, there's no chance whatsoever that they would have accepted and reversed on the second level appeal. So it's a really high standard to meet. So really important when you're standing in the shoes of the patient, as you are with an assignment of benefits, to follow those rules. Even applies if it's not an ERISA plan, because You're not going to have a federal law that's going to require that, but the contract itself may require two levels of appeal, and so you just have to follow that. Then, kind of on the flip side, playing defense, responding to audits, recoupments, and offsets. We've talked about, you know, things to look at in responding to audits. Just don't automatically accept an audit until you understand what the rules of engagement are for that audit. And then if there's a recoupment demand, you need to follow the same rules of, okay, is the recoupment demand for a claim period that's viable either under the contract or under applicable law? And do I have other defenses to this recoupment demand? And so really important to think that through before you just write a check for a recoupment, especially in today's times. And then lastly, an offset. And as we know, an offset is not just a demand for money, but it says, if you don't give me this money back, we're just going to apply what we think that we are owed back on the next good claim. That creates an accounting nightmare for the provider in terms of how they account for each of these claims. And it can also cause a problem for the employer where you've got what they call cross-plan offsetting, which the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals told United you can't do. And so when you get into the offsetting world, really important to know what the rules are, know whether there's a contract right, and know whether there's any court, any sort of a legal prohibition. And then lastly, just in this category, understanding in-network dispute resolution processes. We run into this sometimes where we have a provider client that does the first level appeal, second level appeal, and they want to escalate further, but they don't look further into the contract to see what's required. And so sometimes you can have several other layers before you get to arbitration or litigation. You could have a requirement for a joint operating committee meeting to discuss that particular claim or issue, or a contract operating group issue. You could also have, beyond the contract, well, even within the contract, you could have a mediation requirement. And so you need to look at that. Or you could have a requirement that you give notice of the breach and give them opportunity to cure and have a conversation. So really important to know what those escalation obligations are within the contract. And then beyond that, what we recommend, once you have a trended issue or some other, you know, breach of the contract or other problem, is working with inside counsel to escalate that claim, kind of an inside counsel to inside counsel escalation, and see how that does. Because if you escalate to the in-house counsel, that gets on somebody else's radar screen and gives you a chance for a fresh look at the dispute. And then if you have to go to outside counsel, you need to look at escalating in other ways. And I want to ask Jonathan to talk about what are some alternatives that you could consider, Jonathan, short of filing for arbitration or litigation?
Thanks, David. And first and foremost, you know, we think given this timing and the dynamics with decreased services, extra funds available, there are opportunities to do some special or customized approaches between the providers and the payers. And we do think there will be some receptiveness to this. Some of the alternatives could be, and this kind of goes back to making sure you understand your data, your trended issues, and have the information and documentation available to present. But payers may be receptive to saying, okay, let's address these two issues in a very quick, you know, we'll try and mediate them, or we could even arbitrate in a limited arbitration a finite issue and do claim sampling instead of utilizing a claim by claim approach for everything that's under that issue. So some issues may be able to be taken on a different track, and it doesn't hurt to ask. The other thing that we find is always the first response from a payer in any sort of claims dispute is a challenge to the data that's presented. And that's why David spent a lot of time talking about the different ways to identify the trended issues and present it, because some of the first reactions we get when presenting a spreadsheet is we can't do anything with that. It's just a dump of data and it doesn't tell us anything. It doesn't identify what, if anything, we did wrong or what contract term mandates that something different should have occurred. And so, you know, the presentation of the data and the issues and really the provider's rights to be paid are all necessary to wrap into these, whether we're doing it on a special basis or the contractually defined processes for dispute resolution. One way or another, it's the provider's obligation to tell the story, if you will, with the claims and the data and the contractual rights. Some other alternatives, if we're finding that some of the issues of concern relate to compliance, for instance, let's say you're finding issues on the COVID-19 claims and that a payer is not waiving the patient cost share. Each health plan does also have a compliance officer, and so another alternative would be to address that issue to the compliance officer and ask for assistance in correcting the conduct and making sure the claims get paid. So if that different set of eyes within the health plan sees these issues and recognizes that, yes, in fact, the plan is not quite administering these correctly, that person is able to facilitate change to the organization as well. And so, you know, again, timing is everything in these types of relationships, and we do think there is a good opportunity between now and the end of the year to tackle some, if not all, of the issues you have in your backlogs.
Just a couple of points about out-of-network considerations. It is really important to understand when you're out-of-network, obviously you don't have a contract, but it doesn't mean you don't have rules that you have to follow, because in this particular situation, you're not applying a direct right that you have under a contract. You're applying what's called a derivative right, standing in the shoes of the patient. And so in that particular situation, you really need to make sure, as I said, that you have the assignment of benefits drafted appropriately. And beyond that, you still have to follow the administrative appeal processes. You don't have a contract process to follow, but you have the plan process to follow, and you're at a disadvantage because you actually don't have the plan. The insurance companies are obviously very slow to give the plans to providers in lots of different scenarios. And so here it's helpful to look at a provider manual that the plan has online and try to get some sense as to what their standard rules are for following their rules, because that is what's going to apply unless you have some state law or federal law that controls otherwise. As I mentioned earlier, really important to understand as best you can whether a claim is misclassified as non-emergency, because that's going to significantly affect your reimbursement rate from nearly every plan that I've ever seen, and how, if they underpaid the claim, and in this world, if an underpaid claim is anything less than charges, you may have some model expected payments as something less than charges, but you need to understand why they didn't pay your charges. What methodology did they apply? Because you want to figure out, is there an angle that I have to say that they did not comply with either the plan or applicable law? And then obviously very important here, because you don't have a contract, any sort of discussions that you have with the plan, you really need to understand what's going on. And even if you're in network, so here's an example. Let's say that you call to verify coverage eligibility, and the plan says, yes, this patient is within our plan, and we have coverage for this particular service. You want to log that, because if it turns out that the person that represented that to you was wrong, you may have a claim against that plan, even though the plan, as a matter of fact, does not cover that patient, because you relied upon that representation. So really, really important to document those representations. And we've already talked about the administrative appeal requirements. Another really important thing to think about for out-of-network disputes is you have to think about, what is my applicable timeline? And it's easy to get lost in the idea, okay, well, this is an out-of-network dispute. Under the law, if I don't have a contract, if it's then I may have the same length of time to file a contract action. So let's say the law says I have 6 years to file a breach of contract action. Well, the potential problem is the plan itself may have a time period limitation that's much less than 6 years. So again, really important to drill down on figuring out as soon as you can, what does the plan language say? What are the deadlines? And if there is a deadline, what does state law say about that that might potentially extend that deadline, such as the law in Texas says that if there's an unreasonably short deadline, the state law may extend that deadline for claims that are subject to state law. And then also, as you think about further escalation, understand because you don't have a contract, you're not going to have an arbitration clause. Doesn't mean that you can't agree to arbitrate, but there has to be an agreement. Similarly, there would have to be an agreement to mediate. And then if you don't have agreements along those lines, your remedy may be filing a lawsuit in court. And then also, throughout all of this process, if there's the potential for a going forward contract, that always makes the discussion easier with the plans. If they're interested in a contract with you and for whatever reason you couldn't get together on a contract, always consider the idea of a going forward contract and then finding a way to wrap the past dispute into that going forward contract if that makes economic sense to you. All right, so let's go back for just a minute and talk a little bit more about tracking and challenging payer policy changes. Jonathan?
Thanks, David. I think we've covered most of these aspects thus far, but on the specific issues with the payer policy changes, you know, we really want to reiterate being mindful of the changes to routine language and contracts that a payer policy might impact. A lot of these site of service policies that are coming out, which are restricting where a certain service can be provided to its members, really modify your definition of medical necessity that you agreed to in the agreement. And also impacts how your covered services are defined. So it's very important to look at those aspects and be aware of your existing contractual terms might already address the policy in a way that is in your favor. Similarly with broad medical policy changes, these are often not even included in the manual. These are separate policies that the plans have and that are available on the provider or on the website. But arguably they get incorporated into your agreement. And so you do need to be aware as the payer is modifying either coding edits or these broad medical policies, just to make sure that it's not going to have an impact on what your existing rights are. In the interest of time, let's turn and look ahead to anticipating some changing healthcare delivery models and what we as an organization or a system can really do to anticipate these. We're anticipating several different changes that come out of the pandemic. Obviously, some have been instituted in an emergency fashion, but the question remains, what's going to happen afterwards? Do some of these stick? You know, is it going to modify our delivery patterns? And how do we address them either in contracting or in claims? Some of the changes to historical delivery patterns we see are going to relate to, such things as you have an increase in use of supplies. You have different supplies that need to be used and questions related to whether that is included in existing per diem rates or things like that when you're as a hospital or a provider are expending a lot of money to get these personal protective equipment available for care delivery. And so costs have certainly increased. I doubt you've seen a corresponding rate increase for any of these types of things. The other delivery pattern issue that comes up is what about pre-admission testing to add COVID testing? Oftentimes contract terms will have a requirement that pre-admission testing rendered within the first 3 days or within 3 days prior to the admission are included in the inpatient rate. But now you're providing COVID testing as part of that. That certainly wasn't anticipated as one of those pre-admission testing routines when the contract was entered into. So how do we need to address those types of things? Similarly, telehealth and site of service, obviously there's been a lot of flexibility given during this time to provide telehealth services, but we already see CMS going out and saying that in-person care is the gold standard. And, while they appreciate telehealth's use to try and minimize the spread of COVID, I can definitely see a pushback to the old normal and not relying on telehealth quite as much as we have during this emergency time. Sort of the extent that is important in really modifying how we deliver care in the future in a more efficient and streamlined fashion, we think this should be on the forefront of both providers and payers' minds in working with regulators to see how we can you know, implement telehealth on a more permanent level, you know, across the board. You know, similar issues are coming up with remote patient monitoring, you know, that similarly relates to the telehealth and providing, you know, services where the patient doesn't need to be in the facility. We're also seeing different things coming up with behavioral health and how additional behavioral health services may be provided either in conjunction with medical services or really kind of blurring the historical carve out of those. Ancillary services are the same fashion. What can be done in a different manner than it is being delivered today? And can some of this be done on a remote or telehealth fashion? Suffice it to say that we're expecting that your contracts don't support what you're anticipating you're going to be delivering in the future. And so, you know, it may be a good time now as we look to continue moving through the pandemic and after to assess your contracts, assess where these gaps are, and if your rates are already below market and you're facing, you know, a large segment of services that aren't even covered in the way you're going to be delivering them, you know, it's going to be time for a renegotiation and engaging that payer to try and update that agreement. So we look at it as a very important mechanism to moving forward and strategizing with the various payer partners in how we can update those arrangements moving forward. The other piece that may be worth looking at is, are we ready to move to value-based care if you haven't moved that way, or some other type of population health arrangement in your communities? You know, these models have been evolving over the past several years. Some providers have moved forward, you know, both feet in, but is it time now for those that haven't to consider doing so? So as we continue to anticipate these different things, we take a step back and say, how are our relationships and partnerships going to change? What different referral partners might be involved? What other potential subcontractors need to be involved in helping coordinate care, fill in gaps, or really address a kind of a new model? You know, we have to look at how far payers are going to either push or resist changes in site of service. We see them, and we've talked about the policies where they're pushing to be able to drive services to the lower cost providers in a site of service. But are they also going to resist changes in maybe keeping some permanence of telehealth? You know, finally, how are volumes affected and how are payer mixes changing? You know, with the push to try and drive care to lower cost providers and these policies on site of care, we know that volumes are changing. We know that your past historical volumes, for instance, for outpatient high-tech radiology have likely gone down. We can see that your payer mix may have gone up on the Medicaid side as opposed to commercial. So all these things are going to be coming up, and the question is, what arrangements can you pursue with your payer partners to try and mitigate these? With the volume changes that relate to site of care services, your historical modeling and identification of what contract rate increases would be needed are almost obsolete because they don't address the fact that business won't be coming to you, and then it doesn't address how the rest of the contract should balance out. And so we encourage, you know, our clients to take a look at how they are preparing for negotiations and modeling rate increases with some flux in how those volumes and what services are going to be provided under the arrangements moving forward.
And then other things that are potentially out there, now this is more of a, from on the operational side than on the legal side, but what about the potential need to set up a dedicated COVID-19 unit? And, you know, I guess we think about this a little bit from a PR perspective. You know, what if your volumes just aren't coming back because people continue to be afraid to come to the hospital? Do you have the potential with your physical locations to have a separate physical location that has a COVID-19 unit so you can try to drive your volumes back to the main hospital where you do not have COVID-19 patients? I just throw that out as an idea. based upon conversations we've been having with our various clients. And then kind of thinking creatively, is there an opportunity for a hospital or health system or other provider to get into the world of education, training, and consulting for businesses, along with employee testing for businesses, where they look to the expert physicians and others at the hospitals and health systems for guidance, as they always do, for trying to work through these issues. And then you have to think about, back to the legal side, are there any legal liability issues here? And so, for example, if we give advice to a business about what they need to do to maintain a safer work environment, if a patient comes down with COVID-19, can we be sued for giving negligent advice? And so, for example, in Tennessee, we see that there is in the state legislature, they're working on immunities for various players in the COVID-19 response. And, you know, sure would be nice to have immunity for a hospital or health system or other provider providing good faith advice about best practices for employees returning to work. Same thing for employee testing. You know, what if you have a false negative in testing and an employee infects, you know, the entire work environment? Are you going to be liable for that false negative? And so important to think about all of those issues, but just but also from the operational opportunities as the market evolves for the delivery of healthcare services. So lastly, Jonathan, if you'll talk first a little bit about navigating increased regulatory involvement in these various arrangements.
One follow-up point on the dedicated COVID-19 unit. Dave and I did not spend any time to vaccines and anticipating that process, but we did want to mention that we do have to prepare for vaccines and how it's going to be delivered in the communities, as well as, you know, related acquisition and reimbursement issues. So keep that in the back of your mind as the guidance continues to come out, and if and when we actually have a viable vaccine for patients to have on this, because the communities are going to need the support of all the providers to be able to deliver that vaccine across a very large population. Finally, one of the other things we're seeing is and anticipating is increased regulatory involvement in commercial relationships. We have a fairly new bill that was proposed earlier this year in California requiring consent for various merger and acquisition activities from the Attorney General, as well as some standards for approval of certain types of transactions. You know, and so what we're seeing just as a threshold is additional standards and requirements being inserted into this type of activity, and it's going to have an impact not only on the timing and planning for, you know, mergers and acquisitions, but also potential strategies. And whether or not it makes sense to pursue a transaction or not. You know, we don't see any sort of governance coming down on large insurers and payers acquiring medical groups who are directing the referral patterns and things of that sort. But we're seeing these types of bills in California, and Washington State had one implemented last year that's somewhat similar. So we're seeing issues where the government is going to be stepping in more and more on commercial payer-provider relationships. The other area that you're probably seeing increased regulatory involvement involves your agreements with Medicare Advantage plans or Medicaid managed care. And the regulatory addendums that are coming out and being inserted into contracts with downstream language, while they're somewhat consistent on the Medicare side, the Medicaid side, I'm seeing a lot of variance in the phrasing, terms, obligations, and what's included, and even liberties being taken by the MCO plans themselves to give them the same rights as if they were the government. So be mindful as you see these downstream regulatory addendums that come along with proposed contracts, and make sure you're looking at the terms that are listed there to make sure that they are in fact stating the law accurately and not including any extraneous provisions. It looks like we are up against the end of our time. Again, wanted to thank you for joining us today. And Ashley, did you have some closing remarks?
Yes, thank you. This concludes today's webinar. A recorded version of the presentation and copy of the slides will be available on the PulseNelly website and COVID-19 blog within 24 hours. If you have questions regarding today's content, we encourage you to reach out to our COVID-19 task force. Thank you for your participation.